This isn't so bad at all. Sometime in the next 30 minutes, a group of students came back to the dorms to find the room in disarray. They didn't see what was left of Skopik. He had crawled under the bed. But they did find Jura Ostrogoth's severed head. And by the time they heard the noises coming from behind them, under the bunk, it was far too late. Chapter 20. Lockdown. In the dining hall, an hour later, 120 of the Academy's acolytes, more than half of the student body, were finishing their meal when the mag bolts in the doors clanked shut behind them, sealing them in. Whether it was one of the masters who initiated the sequence or some other factor was never made clear. A fifth-year apprentice named Rucker was the first to discover that they'd actually been locked in. Preoccupied by thoughts of the next day's early combat training, he just shoved harder on the thatchway, assuming it was stuck or broken again, but it still didn't give. Rucker cast a furtive glance over his shoulder to see if he was being messed with, but that did not appear to be the case. None of the others was even looking at him. By the time he'd started trying to use the force to get it open, several of the other students were standing behind him, growing audibly impatient with Rucker, waiting to get out. Even those who hadn't left the tables were watching, waiting to see how this mini-drama would resolve itself. None of them was looking back in the direction of the kitchen until the screaming started. When he heard it, Rucker stopped fighting the blocked hatch and turned to see what appeared to be a group of 6 or 7 Sith students swarming out of the food preparation area, launching themselves at the apprentices still seated over their meals. There was something seriously wrong with the tilt of their faces. He saw that right away. That made them look almost as if their features had been ripped off and stitched sideways on their heads. Their eyes were black and dead, their oily skin putty-colored and lifeless, except for their mouths, which were twisted back in grinning scimitars of unmistakable hunger. And they were screaming together as one. At this point, Rucker, who had approximately 30 seconds left of life as he knew it, saw the things overtaking the room completely in a series of brief, high-contrast impressions. It was like watching some kind of parasite latch onto its prey. Their already wide mouths somehow spread out even wider still, clamping down on the faces and necks and chests of the first rows of victims, taking them down with phenomenal strength and speed. Trays flew. Bright helices of blood spurted and looped in the air. A great bundle of steaming intestines splattered the floor to Rucker's right, with the ripe, coppery smell of meat fresher than anything that had ever been served here before. All around him, Rucker saw the other apprentices fighting back. They were using force techniques, chokes and pushes and jumps, but the corpses tore through them indiscriminately. The only thing that seemed to have any effect was crushing the creatures or pinning them under something so heavy that they couldn't get free. When one of the things seized him around the throat, Rucker raised one hand and tried to lift the table in front of him, flipping it over. But the thing on his neck was too strong, too hungry. Rucker's knees buckled, his legs caved in, and he dropped to the floor, smelling the fetor of the thing's breath even as its teeth gouged through his flesh. His vision flickered and grew intensely sharp, as if in the final seconds his senses had grown more acute. Desperate to take in all that they could before oblivion descended. Across the dining hall, he caught a glimpse of one of the apprentices standing on a table with both arms outstretched. Two of the living corpses went flailing backward, slamming into the opposite wall 30 meters away. The attacking apprentice, he had long, flaming red hair and penetrating green eyes, stood perfectly still, waiting for the things to come back. Nothing about what was happening seemed to perturb him in the least. In fact, Rucker realized, he could actually catch a hint of what the other student was thinking as he looked at the bodies and... The power. power, and the other student wanted to be like them. Rucker let out a silent groan. Blood was trickling down into his vision now, blackness closing in fast. But just before it covered him up completely, he could finally make out the identity of the red-headed apprentice standing on the table. It was Lusk. Rucker saw now that he was about to get his wish.
Come on, then!
Lusk was laughing, jeering as the things charged at him. He stopped fighting them off and instead had allowed them full access to his wrists, which Rucker saw he'd slashed open with a dinner knife. Blood poured from his arms.
Come on and take me!
His voice became a scream.
Chapter 21. Headstone City.
Trace landed at nightfall. The main hangar of the Academy was empty. Disengaging the ship's main hatch, he jumped down from the cockpit and forced himself to stop and wait on the landing pad, his senses, both physical and telemetric, tuned for any immediate threat. The challenge, of course, was that this entire planet was a threat. Besides the blizzard raging overhead, the Sith Academy was a black hive of dark side energy. Trace could feel it buzzing around him like a huge swarm of venomous insects. The psychic contamination was so thick, so total, that for a moment he felt a blur of vertigo attacking his balance, tilting it dangerously off kilter. She's here. He knew it, even though he hadn't received any further bursts of distress from her along the way. Zoe's kidnapper had brought her here. Trace felt her presence, recognized it somewhere amid the snowy ruin of the Academy itself. He moved quickly across the hangar, measuring every ambient sound as a possible threat. Since there had been no way of disguising his arrival, his ship wasn't equipped with a cloaking device, he'd decided to head straight into the thick of things, anticipating a hostile reaction that he'd likely have to fight his way out of. He ran past a control booth and stopped there. The hatchway hung open, dangling sideways, as if it had been partially ripped off its housing. The chair lay on its side in front of the main flight control console, a data pad, and a pile of old holomags with titles like Hot Ships and Kuat Classics. Reaching inside, Trace rested two fingertips on the chair. A vivid splash of violence erupted in his mind's eye. A man screaming, jerking backward, while a pair of pale hands groped through, clutching his shirt and trying to pull him out. Trace felt the man's trapped panic, his horror, as he tried to keep whatever it was away from him. That part of the image was just a crazed, blood-soaked blur, defined more by its frantic strength than any kind of shape or form. An instant later, the image faded. What else had happened here? He left the control area and strode the rest of the way through the hangar. It was becoming fully dark as he stepped outside and stared at the ruins stretched out around him, fading into a horizon. He'd glimpsed the Academy during his descent, but it looked bigger from the ground. Kilometers across, all of it, he thought. Honeycombed with subterranean passageways and countless hiding places. Lights flickered, dotting the twilight with motion, or the illusion of motion. People were moving out there. He sensed them. Sith students and masters. That didn't matter. He would find her. A sudden gust of wind slammed him in the face, carrying with it a rich and fetid stench of decay. Trace narrowed his eyes, essaying the winding networks of broken walkways that led among buildings and temples and piles of old stone. Given the smell, they reminded him of capillaries on the face of a cadaver. His eyes settled on a tall black structure jutting upward, far above the other, lowlier structures. Its top swathed in snow. A tower, like a headstone amid a city of the dead. It was a start. He began walking.
Chapter 22. Practicum. Practicum.
When Zoe saw what Tulka was pointing at, she felt sick. He had led her up to the top of a flat, ice-slick slab of rock that might once have been the roof of some unused building. It was dark, but the whippet had a phosphorescent glow rod that lit up the night like a thick slice of midday, and in the end she saw much more than she wanted to. After a long moment of forcing herself to stare at the pulpy thing that squirmed in front of her, Zoe realized that she was looking at the student from Scabrous's laboratory, the one that had crawled out of the cage. Tulka must have recognized it. That was why he'd brought her up here to look at it. The thing's leg was pinned under a pile of rocks, and its head swung at an impossible angle from its upper torso, as though the neck was broken in several places. Yet even so, it writhed and shrieked and snapped at them, thrusting itself forward as if it could somehow break itself in half and attack with whatever portion of its body it could pull off. The whippet poked at it with a spear. The thing in front of them screamed again, its head twisting snake-like all the way around. As horrible as it was, Zoe thought the final remaining vestiges of humanity on its face were far worse. If she looked hard enough, she thought she could still see a dead teenager in there, fallen into a prison of its own decaying flesh.
"Explain that," Tulka said.
"Me?" she asked. "You're the one who brought us here. Now we're both stuck in the middle of it." One finger tapped her firmly in the middle of her chest.
"You're stuck."
"What about you?"
"I'm already gone."
Tulka turned away, took three steps, and stopped, looking down off the edge of the overhang. The long, oscillating scream that rose up around them now did not come from the thing smashed under the rock pile. It came instead from down below, and when Zoe joined Tulka at the edge of the overhang, she could see where he had shown the glow rod. The others, six of them, Sith students, she saw. The fronts of their uniforms caked in gore, clustered together, their gray faces upturned to show eyes that glittered with that same shared intensity of appetite. When they screamed together. One of them was a Zabrak. The others were, had been, human. Zoe snapped a glance back at the corpse, whose leg was trapped under the rock.
"It's calling them."
The orchid's voice broke through in her mind.
"Summoning them up here, Estizo."
When the scream ended, she heard an eager scratching noise. The other students had already shoved forward, grabbing the ragged surface in front of them, clawing at it. They began to climb.
Chapter 23. Lowboy. Lowboy.
Where is everybody? That was what Kindra had asked Ra'at when they were outside, and he'd blown it off, or pretended to, because he didn't have an answer, or because the answer he had was too deeply disturbing to vocalize. But the question returned to him now, down in the dorms, as they went through room after room, finding nothing but empty, silent bunks and vacant corridors. They had been running for some time, but Kindra didn't even sound as if she was out of breath, and Ra'at realized that he was starting to feel better too. Moving around had helped him clear his head, steadying him. Even his arm didn't hurt as much anymore. Being young had its advantages. Going low had been Kindra's idea, a means of buying time until they figured out what they were up against. And despite Ra'at's avowed intention to go to the infirmary and get checked out, he'd followed her. For now, anyway. They'd run inside a long utility corridor to a place where it branched off in a three-pronged intersection. The permasteel ceiling oozed condensation just above him. and the long tube lamps embedded in the walls let off a pale, achromatic glow in the hanging clouds of moisture. The opposite end of the corridor intersected another group of dorms, and that was where they'd run into two other students, Hartwig and Mags.
"What are you two doing down here?" Hartwig asked. He frowned at Rat. "Dag, man, what happened to your arm?"
"Training accident," Rat said evenly. Hartwig smirked.
"Fail."
"Meaning what?"
"Meaning that."
Hartwig pointed at the wound.
"Doesn't look like any training accident I ever saw. What did you do, fall on a vibroblade or something?"
"I was in the pain pipe."
Rat held Mags and Hartwig in the same regard that he did the rest of his classmates, with a kind of suspicious indifference. Their motives were purely selfish, as were his. He had no intention of sharing information that didn't somehow improve his own situation. At this point, they all knew something had gone very wrong, contaminating the academy or the entire planet. For the moment, they were allies of opportunity.
"Have you guys seen anything else down here?"
"What do you mean, anything?" Hartwig asked.
"Or anybody?"
"No."
Mags cracked his knuckles nervously.
"Not yet. Weird, huh? It's pretty early for it to be so quiet. I heard there was some kind of assembly earlier, but Wig and I missed it."
"If we're going any farther," Kendra cut in, "we're going to need weapons. Our best bet is dividing up." She pointed up ahead where the corridor pronged into three separate halls. "Searching these hallways, groups of two and..."
"Wait a minute," Hartwig said. "Who put you in charge?"
"In charge?" Kendra turned, and Ra'at saw that she was staring directly at Hartwig. Her gray, almost translucent irises like newly formed frost.
"Nobody asked you to tag along."
Her eyes flashed off Ra'at.
"Any of you?"
Hartwig shrugged uneasily.
"I'm just saying..."
"What?"
"We all feel something kind of bad in the air, right? Like maybe some kind of a disease. But who's to say it's not just one of Scabrous's drills?"
Kendra's eyebrows went up.
"Excuse me? For all we know, he started this himself."
"Why?"
"Maybe it is a training exercise," Mags put in. "Or maybe he's culling the weak students. It's happened before. Remember the Unaki eye spiders?"
"This is worse," Kendra said.
"Don't be so sure," Hartwig said. 11 students went blind, 2 of them died. Remember Soyd Einray?"
"Soyd Einray was a defective already."
"Maybe, but he still hung himself afterward. And then we found out that Scabrous had reactivated the fertilized spider eggs from the pathogen bank as a nerve reflexivity drill."
Hartwig refused to lower his stare.
"I still wake up with blood in my eyes sometimes."
Kendra's expression didn't change. "What's your point?"
"You want weapons? I might know where we could find some, but I'm not going to risk getting in trouble with the Masters if nobody's actually seen anything."
Hartwig waited for a response, looking at Kendra, then at Ra'at, and finally let out a derisive snort.
"Yeah, that's what I thought." He turned to go. "I'll see you puss bags around."
"Wait," Ra'at said. "I saw something." Hartwig stopped and turned to look at him. Ra'at saw Kendra's tongue come out and moisten her upper lip, listening expectantly. 2 bodies fell out of Scabrous's tower," Ra'at said. "They hit the ground. I saw them hit, and I heard the noise they made. They were dead." He swallowed. His throat was suddenly very dry. "But then they got up." Mags and Hartwig were both staring at him now with various degrees of skepticism and outright disbelief. Ra'at discovered that he didn't care.
"Let them doubt. It would only make them better cannon fodder when the time came."
"Were you all alone when you saw this?" Kendra asked.
"I was sparring with Lusk."
Mags blinked at him,
and Hartwig's eyes grew wide. Maybe it was just Ra'at's imagination, but he thought the mention of Lusk's name brought a paradoxical shiver of credibility to the moment. It was too unlikely a detail to be made up.
One of the ones who fell was Wim Nichter, Rat said. After he hit the ground, he got up and attacked me. He was dead, but he was still alive. I had to pin him under a pile of rocks to get away. Out with the rest of it, then, he decided. That sickness in the air that you're talking about, that Scabrous is doing up in the tower, I think...
He swallowed again, and this time his voice was steadier.
I think he's bringing the dead back to life. There was a sharp rattle of footsteps from somewhere in front of them.
Rat felt a sudden feeling of coolness rising up inside him, as if his skin were being stretched by gallons of cold water.
When he spoke, his voice seemed to be transmitting from somewhere far away. Which way is it coming from? Cocking her head, Kendra pointed up ahead, where the main corridor divided into three sub-corridors, to the one that branched on the left.
Up there, she whispered. You hear it?
Rat's ears strained for sound. At first he heard nothing. Then they all did. A dragging, grating clank. It was advancing down the walkway with a graceless lack of stealth, growing steadily louder with every passing second. Rat began concentrating solely on himself and his own survival, forgetting all the others. The masters at the academy had trained them to fight as a unit when necessary, but a Sith warrior's true strength lay in his or her own personal will to power. When you could trust no one, fighting alone was axiomatic, a natural state. Flattening himself to the wall, he felt the Force's dark side coursing through him, a crackling electric chill that rendered fear and apprehension obsolete, and welcomed it. In that moment, he felt only a ready vigilance, weightless and unrelenting. Since arriving here on Odacer Faustin, it was the closest to happiness that he dared let himself experience. Yet in so many ways, it was superior to any happiness he'd ever encountered. It made traditional happiness look anemic by comparison. All at once he realized that he could see what was coming, not with his eyes, but in his mind. Relax, he breathed. It's okay. Kendra wrinkled her forehead, about to reply, when the droid rattled from the end of the tunnel, stopped, and regarded them dully. It was a bare-bones Sigma Series training unit, eight-armed, with belt treads and a force-feedback intelligence implant so rudimentary that it was practically a piece of furniture. Ra'at hadn't seen one like it since he'd run newbie lightsaber drills, not long after his arrival here. Its copper-blue chassis was a dented utility cabinet, carbon-scored, with hundreds of old marks from countless years of clumsy rookies. Heaving a sigh, Hartwig came away from the wall, watching the others emerge into view around it.
What's that thing doing so far down here?
Mags muttered. The droid clicked and produced a series of broken-sounding whirs, its equivalent of speech.
Equipping such a unit with a vocabulator would have been pointless.
Rat reached down and grabbed a loose strip of alloy sealant dangling from its undercarriage, pried it off, and wedged it directly underneath the thing's bulky central processor. He jammed the strip in as far as he could and twisted. What are you doing? Kendra asked. The processor cowl came loose with a snap. If I remember right, he said, this thing still got a visual mapping system.
He eased his right hand between two hot layers of components,
which means it should still have a playback function. And whatever it's seen lately should still be stored somewhere in its memory bank. He didn't glance up. Master Yakata used to make us watch our old drills this way, remember?
Yeah, Mag said, but...
The space in front of them flickered and brightened with a cone of holographic blue light, the image sharpening, gaining resolution and depth. They all stood back looking at it, pale blue reflecting off their faces, none of them speaking. At first, Ra'at didn't quite realize what he was seeing. Mags was the first to break the silence. He sounded hoarse, as if he was still trying to whisper, but needed to clear his throat.
What is that?
Nobody answered. The hologram showed an area somewhere deep inside the tunnels where an indistinct mob of figures was teeming not quite randomly in the foreground. From their uniforms, Ra'at realized that they were Sith acolytes. But there was something wrong about the way their bodies moved, a jolting, uneven pace, and he couldn't see their faces. From this angle, it was impossible to tell how many there were. All he could see was that they were hunched together, working over what looked like a massive pile of debris, shoving and piling and dropping it into place in the corridor ahead of them. Within just a few moments, the pile in the tunnel had grown noticeably higher. The light on the other side was narrowing to a thin band.
"What are they doing?" Mags asked.
Rat's voice was a non-specific whisper.
"Building a wall."
"Maybe it's some kind of barricade," Hartwig said, "so they can hold off whatever's out there." He caught his breath. "It must be..."
"Look,"
Ra'at pointed at the hologram. "The angle's changing.
Maybe they've got weapons we can use."
Mags was sounding excited now.
"Yeah, look, that one's got a lightsaber."
He was already heading up in the direction that the droid had come.
"Let's move."
"Wait," Ra'at said.
"What?"
Mags turned around frowning.
"What's wrong?"
Ra'at was still looking at the hologram. The droid had broadened its field of view, dumping on bandwidth, and the image's signal-to-noise ratio had improved dramatically. Now the blue light cone showed a huge mob of bodies, dozens of them, more than he could even count, crammed together in front of the barrier. It looked like half the students at the academy were packed into that part of the tunnel. Ra'at pointed.
"Their faces."
Mags came back, hardly paying attention.
"I don't see what..."
he said and stopped.
"Oh, no."
Several of the Sith students in the hologram were turning and looking directly back at the droid. Their faces were slack and vacant, devoid of any emotion. It was the exact same way that Nictor had looked up on top of the overhang. Ra'at saw that some of them had wounds on their faces and necks, and their uniforms were badly torn, hanging from their torsos like bloody sails. He watched as one of them, a student whose name he couldn't remember, brought his face directly up to the droid's holocam, a sly grin peeling over his lips.
"Like Nictor,"
Ra'at murmured, and felt Kindra stiffening next to him in his peripheral vision. Hartwig said,
"What?"
"There's light on the other side of that barricade," Ra'at said.
"But that's it."
"So what are they doing?"
Ra'at looked back at him. "They're walling us in."
Chapter 24, Seed.
It was the orchid that saved them. Looking back, Zoe hadn't even been aware of exactly what she was doing, although that by itself shouldn't have been a surprise. A good deal of a Jedi's power was instinctive, a function of the Force. But it didn't make the situation any less disturbing. The things beneath them had started clambering up the rock face with a kind of manic agility, clawing their way toward her and Tulka in spastic bursts of movement. The Whippet reacted first, drawing his spear and thrusting it straight at the first one, impaling it through the chest and then hauling it upright, using the thing's own weight to drag it down and finish the job. Tulka swung the spear around with the corpse still on it, bludgeoning the others, driving them back with a series of vicious thrusts. The plan went wrong almost immediately. Despite the fact that it had been run through completely, the thing at the end of the spear wasn't stopping. It wasn't even slowing down. And Zoe realized the other corpses had changed their approach, climbing up onto the overhang from the other side while Tulka was still struggling to kill the first one.
"They can't be killed," a voice whispered from the back of her mind. "They're already dead. Look at them."
At first, she thought she was hearing her own thoughts,
and then she realized it was the Murakami orchid, roiling in its own guilt and misery, yammering out words that she alone could hear. Dead but alive, Hestiso. Dead but alive. I did this to them. It was my fault. When Scabrous put me into that horrible vat, and now I'm inside them.
Zoe stiffened.
That must have been when she made the connection, on some level at least, because a moment later she was staring straight at the dead thing wiggling on the end of Talca's spear.
Except it wasn't really at the end anymore. It had pulled itself forward until it was almost close enough to grab the whippet's face. I've got an idea, she told the orchid.
Grow.
What? You're in them now, aren't you? You're a part of them. You said so yourself.
Yes, but...
Then grow.
I can't just...
Don't argue with me. Just grow. It might have been that last command, the desperate vehemence of it, that stirred the orchid to action. Zoe saw the thing at the end of Tolka's spear stiffen and then fall abruptly motionless, as if it had just realized something profoundly unwelcome was taking root inside it. An instant later, a thin green tendril began to wind itself out of the thing's right ear, extruding a vine that grew steadily thicker as it looped downward. Another vine appeared inside its left nostril, and then a third and fourth. Stalks and runners were snaking busily out of both ears now, some of them bearing small clusters of leaves, others tiny black flowers. The corpse's mouth opened, and another stalk, this one as big around as Zoe's finger, burst outward from its bloody throat.
Hestiso, this hurts. This hurts me.
Grow. Grow. Just keep growing. Just grow. Looking around, she saw the others were experiencing the same effect, sprouting stalks and stems from every visible orifice. Their faces squirmed with thin, wiggling plant life just underneath the skin. Zoe knew that it was working now. The orchid was in them, and the orchid was growing. She concentrated harder. She could actually see the flora growing inside the things now, driving it harder, farther, faster from within, even as the orchid began crying out, begging her to stop, telling her that this hurt. It couldn't do it anymore. She ignored it and stared straight at the thing on Tulka's spear. She thought the word again, thought it with all the intensity and determination she could muster, over and over in a smooth and solid thought wave. Grow, 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 grow. The corpse's entire cranial vault exploded in a colossal splat of red and black and green. In the place where its skull had been, a bright spray of leaves flapped and writhed, winding outward, spilling down to encompass the entire upper half of the thing's torso. The body fell limp, sagging on the spear. Tulka dumped the thing with a brisk shoveling gesture, kicking it so that it barrel rolled over the edge and then glanced back at Zoe.
You did that?
Me and the flower.
You better do it again.
The whippet pointed over the edge of the overhang at the other things. They were still sprouting, Zoe saw, but not as quickly, clawing back upward toward them.
Hestiso, please.
The orchid sounded weaker now.
No more. Not now. I can't. It hurts.
You have to, Zoe said, unaware that she was speaking out loud. You have to do it, because if you don't, they're not going to stop. They're going to kill us. They're going to kill me. Do you understand?
So sorry, Hestiso.
Silence. And it was gone. A hand closed around her ankle, jerking her forward from below. Zoe started to fall, landing on her side just as one of the things lurched upward, fully into view. She tried to pull away, but couldn't budge.
Grow,
she pleaded with the orchid.
Grow! Grow, now!
But the flower, wherever it had gone, whatever its abilities had been just moments before, was of absolutely no help to her now. She couldn't even hear its voice anymore. And the writhing, rippling movement under the other thing's faces seemed to have stopped. There was nothing more they could do about them now. The orchid was tired, or absent, or dead. The thing on her leg was dragging her closer.
What are you doing?
Tolka shouted. He was stabbing furiously at the others, without much effect.
Stop them!
I can't, Zoe shouted back. The orchid's not there anymore.
All at once, something huge burst up out of the ground in front of them. A monolith, black and featureless, hurling up an enormous corona of rock and ice in its wake. From what Zoe could make out, it looked like a turret made of stone and durasteel, taller than the rocky outcropping where she was currently fighting for her life. Lights pulsed within it. As its domed upper mounting swung toward them, she saw the gleam of a heavy turbine. The blaster pulsed twice, and the corpse in front of her disappeared in an acrid spray. Zoe blinked, wiping her eyes, and a massive amount of strength and momentum slammed into her from behind. The whippet, she realized, knocking her off the top of the overhang just before the third blast pulverized it completely. They landed face first in the dirty snow, Zoe's ears ringing, her head splitting from the fusillade of laser blasts behind them. Massive hunks of smoking boulder and snow were showering down from above. Zoe stared back at the crater where they'd just been standing.
Run, Tolka ordered.
What?
That way.
He jerked his arm toward the long, hollowed-out tube-like structure 20 meters in front of them. And when she didn't move, the whippet shoved her forward just as the laser cannon pivoted again, tracking straight for her.
Chapter 25. Positive ID.
Statement.
The HK's voice crackled from inside the comlink.
Sir, we located his diesel trace.
The Sith Lord paused and adjusted the frequency until the connection became clear. He was standing in the bulkhead of the Miro call, having just finished a complete inspection of the vessel from top to bottom. Locating the bounty hunter's ship had not been difficult. The tower's sensors had found it crash-landed 2 kilometers outside the academy, tracking it from the heat signature. And Scabrous had approached it with absolute stealth, on the off chance there might be someone aboard. But there was no sign of the Jedi or the Whippet who had brought her here. The craft had been abandoned.
Where is she?
He asked.
Response. Initial perimeter scan reports positive identification on the northeast quadrant. Scanners registered a 98.3% positive pheromone match.
How long ago?
Response. 10 standard minutes, sir. Coordinate vector 27 by 18, order of magnitude...
Is she dead? The slightest of pauses.
Response. Negative, sir. Per your orders...
Good.
Statement. Our mid-range scout systems report that she and the Whippet Bounty Hunter are traveling together, headed northwest toward the Tonton paddock in that near vicinity. They are still on foot and in all probability seeking immediate cover from the initial attack.
The HK made a clicking sound, awaiting orders.
Query. Shall I reactivate the perimeter cannons in that quadrant set for stun?
Scabrous didn't answer right away, thinking about the terrain that the droid was describing. The tower itself wasn't far from there, of course, and the library.
That won't be necessary, Scabrous said. I'll handle it personally.
Statement.
The droid sounded more tentative now.
There is something else.
What is it?
Several local sensors are reporting unverified cluster activity in various quadrants around the academy in general. It's unclear exactly what the source of the activity is. Biorhythm diagnostics aren't reporting any verifiable vital signs.
Then fix it.
Clarification. The electronics themselves are online and functioning normally. It's the activity. It shows no sign of life. Body temperature, respiration, heart or brain activity.
Scabrous stopped and gazed thoughtfully at the Miro call's dented metal bulkhead in front of him. For a moment, the only sounds were the low, steady hum of the hemodialysis machine pumping fresh blood through his body, and the susurrus of fluids whisking through tubes, feeding him the cocktail of antiviral drugs.
How much activity? He asked.
Response. Unclear at present, but it seems to be...
What?
Well, it seems to be spreading, sir.
I see. Scabrous thought of the apprentice, Nictor, or the thing that had once been Nictor, crawling out of its cage despite the fact that all vital signs registered negative. He thought about how the thing had lunged at him and then gone after Juro Ostrogoth, the appetite that the thing had brought to bear. At that moment, Scabrous had assumed that what he'd seen was a kind of exaggerated nervous twitch, a biochemical accident that the drug and the orchid had triggered inside Nictor's body. But now, it seems to be spreading, sir, the HK had said. He began to reconsider.
My lord?
The droid prompted. Never mind that now, Scabrous said. I'm going directly to the library. There will be no more need for lasers. Hestizo Trace will meet me there personally, and we shall finish our business together, she and I, as it was meant to be. Have my own ship prepared for immediate departure afterward.
Yes, sir, but...
Scabrous cut off the transmission and strolled through the Miro-Corps open hatch, down the landing ramp, and out into the snowy night.
Chapter 26, Sub-Zero. In the first hour that Trace passed through the collapsed walls and stone temples of the Academy, the blizzard around him only worsened. It was as if the planet itself had read his arrival as a kind of infection on the cellular level and was fighting him off however it could. The temperature, already freezing, continued to plunge until his throat and lungs burned with every breath. The wind roared between the massive boxy shapes of the buildings and substructures, the great slabs and half-submerged corridors. Its scream was wraith-like, endless, the cry of something hungry for more than simple meat. Even the pellets of snow themselves felt sharper, jagging into his skin like tiny bits of shrapnel from an endlessly recurring explosion. In his peripheral vision, a shadow twitched and slithered. Trace stopped, hand reaching back for his lightsaber, and that was when he saw the man stepping out of the arched doorway to his left. Even before Trace glimpsed the man's face, he sensed the thin, bitter smile twisted over his lips. The threat of violence in those half-lidded eyes. The man's tunic and cloak blew out behind him, snapping whip-like in the irregular gusts of wind. And his voice, when it came across the broken landscape between them, was a low snarl. You landed on the wrong world, Jedi. Trace turned and faced him directly. The man was a Sith Master. That much was readily apparent. Perhaps an instructor at the Academy. I am Shackwith, Blade Master here on Odessa Faustin. I can only assume that you came here seeking humiliation and an unpleasant death. I'm here on other matters. Ah? The Blade Master cocked his head slightly, looking marginally intrigued. But you've found me instead. Trace nodded. Actually, it was only stillness that had found him, clarity of thought. And it came as a blessing. The cold, the darkness, the stinging wind, all of these outside factors had simply ceased to exist. His entire world had shrunk to the exact distance between him and the man who stood before him, an obstacle in the way of finding Hestizo. Trace felt everything inside him beginning to relax and flow smoothly as the force spread through his nerves and muscles, generating a kind of weightless balance between action and intent. He drew his own lightsaber, felt it blaze to life in his grasp, a perfect extension of himself. The Sith Master's response was immediate. With a harsh grunt of fury,
He flew at Trace, vaulting upward in the wind and angling the blade down with both hands, ripping through the ground where Trace had just been standing. The execution was flawless, a thing of almost organic brutality, as if the Blade Master had become a force of nature, another component of the blizzard that roared around them. Yet he was still too slow. Leaping sideways, Trace had spun around with his own lightsaber extended in front of him in a sweeping blow. The Sith Master was there, deflecting the attack and charging him again, hammering him backward with a vicious series of piercing thrusts and jabs, offering no quarter. Twice, the blade came close enough to Trace's face that he could smell the scorched stubble on his cheek. The third slash came within millimeters of taking off his head. Trace realized that regardless of what Shacklet had said a moment earlier, the Blade Master didn't intend to humiliate him, to toy with him, or prolong the duel any longer than necessary. At this point, the Sith Master was attacking for the most primitive reason imaginable: to slaughter Trace and leave his steaming carcass in the snow. In that split second, Trace saw the rest of the duel playing out in two distinct ways, neither of which would last long. Death was hovering over them now like a scavenger, close and claustrophobic. He saw it reflected in the Sith Master's eyes. When the red blade came at him again, Trace jumped upward. He put everything he knew about Form 5's Degemso variation into that jump, leaping over Shacklet, spiraling through the flying snow, landing on the other side and twisting around instantly, keeping his lightsaber at throat level with the intention of finishing the duel in a single stroke. Shacklet laughed, a bone-dry chuckle, and deflected the maneuver with mocking ease. He swung at Trace, and this time the Jedi felt a hot, bright stab of pain as the lightsaber seared through his cloak and tunic, slashing into the flesh along his ribcage. Drops of blood fell into the snow, disappearing as they melted.
Too easy, Jedi!
Now the Blade Master's shoulders and back were braced against the slouching stone wall behind him, its outer surface cracked and half collapsed, and he tensed to spring forward.
Now I shall finish you!
As he arched forward, Trace saw a pair of hands shoot out from the broken wall behind him, gripping the Blade Master by the throat and jerking him backward. Shacklet slammed into the cracked stone hard enough to drop his lightsaber, and Trace saw a ghastly white face burst up through the open hole in the wall. A screaming face, suctioning down on the Sith Master's right cheek and eye, teeth bared, gouging into his face. Trace took a step back, still holding his own lightsaber up, watching the thing that hauled Shacklet through the hole in the wall where it could more easily devour him. Great arterial eruption spurted from the ragged perforation in the Sith Master's throat, spraying up over the wall and down into the snow and ice, painting the whole world red. Inside the wall, the thing lifted its face up and Trace saw its eyes, flat and without the slightest spark of life. Yet they had once been human, even youthful. A Sith student, he realized. A teenager. What had happened? The thing shoved its mouth back down into the ragged red cup that had once been Shacklet's right eye socket, slurping noisily. When it paused a moment later, the noise that it made was a high-pitched, ululating scream, and Trace realized that there were other screams, countless screams, a threnody of them rising up along with it, coming from every direction at once. The night was full of them.
Chapter 27, Paddock.
Zoe and Tulka ducked through the entranceway of the long, tunnel-like structure, and the bounty hunter stopped and raised his head, sniffing the wind as if picking up on some obscure scent. "What was that out there?" Zoe asked, gazing back out through the way they'd come. Her own voice sounded distant to her, and her ears felt as if they were plugged with soft wax from the force of the explosions outside.
"Turbo laser," Tulka grunted. "Heavy artillery."
"It's Scabrous, isn't it?" she asked. "He's looking for us." If the Whippet heard the question, he ignored it. A moment later, he sidled on, deeper into the foul-smelling recesses of the building. Reluctantly, Zoe followed. She was still processing the attacks, the laser cannon that had erupted up out of the ground, and the even more horrifying assault that had come before it, the screaming, undead things that had been intent on devouring them. "The orchid," she said, for want of a better place to start. Talca said nothing, kept walking. The smell around them was getting decidedly worse with every passing step. "It was the only reason I could fight those things off. It's because of how Scabrous used it in that experiment. I think it's inside their bodies, somehow. I told it to grow, but..." Zoe shook her head. "It's not there anymore. Now I can't get it to respond to me at all. It might be dead." The Whippet responded to all of this with a grunt.
"You finished?"
"I just thought you might want to know how I saved our lives back there. You were the one who asked me for an explanation, after all."
"My mistake."
"Really?" she said. "Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe you should have thought of that before you abducted me and dragged me out here to a planet full of walking corpses." No reply from the Whippet. "Where are we going, anyway?"
"Taking shelter, waiting out the storm. In the morning, I'm going back to my ship."
The conversation ended there. Almost without meaning to, Zoe found herself reaching into the bounty hunter's thoughts, tentatively exploring his mind for some idea of what he knew about where they were headed. Normally, her telepathic abilities weren't particularly strong when it came to non-plant life forms, but the Whippet was what she thought of as a relatively easy read. In fact, from within, his mind resembled nothing so much as the trophy room aboard his ship where she'd first awakened. A place of death. A de facto display space for grotesque trophies and old kills. Some were alien species that she'd never seen before. Others were human. All were brought together in universal expressions of pain, desperation, and helplessness that they'd worn as the bounty hunter had delivered the coup de grace. His mind had become a storehouse of their dying moments. This crypt of suffering, this reliquary, wasn't just what he carried around in his head every day. It was his head. Undaunted, Zoe plumbed deeper and realized, with some effort, she was able to pass through these thoughts into another chamber of the Whippet's consciousness, into his more distant memories. She saw faces rising up around her, others of his species, family perhaps, early enemies from his home planet of Tula. The atmosphere here felt very still and long undisturbed, almost as if it were hermetically sealed, and she wondered if she'd arrived in some part of Tulka's past that he himself rarely visited. Certainly she had such places in her own mind, aspects of her life she'd walled off in vain hopes they'd die of suffocation or neglect. Zoe could almost feel the membrane that enveloped this part of his thoughts beginning to constrict over her. Then she heard breathing. There was something alive in here. She shifted her focus away from the older memories and saw the man gazing down at her, utterly calm and pleasant. His gray eyes were clear, sparkling with intellect. Wide, almost sensuous lips seemed perpetually on the verge of speaking, but instead they only twisted into a bemused smile. It was the Sith Lord.
"Get out of my head, Jedi."
Tulka's snarl boomed through the memory caverns around her with devastating force. Zoe recoiled, drawing back, staggering as she retreated, and looking around, she saw that they were standing in a wide, bare metal chamber facing a series of tunnels that branched off in different directions. Icicles spiked down like semi-translucent stalactites from the long, low ceiling. She couldn't breathe. It took a second to realize why. The Whippet had one hand locked around her throat, clamping her airway shut between his thumb and forefinger. His tusk face loomed just centimeters from her own.
"The next time I catch you in my head, you'll lose yours. Is that clear?"
Zoe nodded, and he released her, allowing her to stumble backward, regaining her bearings. Somewhere across the room, in one of the adjoining tunnels, she could hear a high-pitched, whining beep going on and on. Not an alarm, necessarily, but some incidental mechanism, maybe as simple as a light that had already started overheating and would eventually burn out. Right now, however, this area was still brightly lit. Presumably, that was why Tulka had chosen it. As far as temperature went, the space was an ice locker, but at least she could see what was around and between each of the broad utilitarian pillars holding up the ceiling. The Whippet turned, head cocked, and listening as he lumbered back up the corridor. Zoe, who at this point had spent a good deal of time looking at his back, noticed a difference in his gait, the way he carried his shoulders. They were stiffened, tense with anticipation. Without breaking stride, he reached for his bow and started to draw an arrow from his quiver. "Is this the way we came in?" Zoe asked.
"What do you think?"
"I think you're not sure, and you're trying to cover for it." She paused and sniffed the air. The feral ammonia-foul odor was growing thicker around her. "Are we staying down here all night? What's that smell?" No answer from Tulka. At this point, had she really expected one? She went after him down the concourse in the general direction of the exit. The lights were trembling even more erratically here, sputtering on and off for a second or two at a time. The acrid stench had become eye-wateringly intense. Zoe covered her nose and mouth. It didn't help at all. "This isn't the way we came in," she coughed. "I would have remembered." Tulka stopped. Off to their right, she saw a row of stalls. Something inside one of the stalls was swinging itself around, chuffing out volumes of air. Listening, Zoe heard it let out a low, restless groan. There was a silence, then a sound of feet rustling, followed by a bronchial squabbling honk. The Whippet replaced the arrow that he'd taken out and took a step forward. The thing inside the stall let out another nasal, braying squawk and thrust its long head outward. Its muzzle drew back, and Zoe saw two pairs of nostrils, large and small, flaring to let out another blast of moist breath. It swung its shaggy head sideways, its curved horns nearly gouging Tulka's face before he drew back. "Are they
Tauntauns?"
The Whippet made it sound like a bad word about somebody's mother.
"At least it explains the
A thick gobbet of spit hit him squarely in the face, and Tulka lunged forward, wiping it off, meeting the Tauntaun eye to eye. He and it were almost the same height. The snow lizard's lips were already working up another load of saliva. Zoe thought the thing actually looked like it was smirking at him, when Tulka abruptly broke into a grin. It was the first time Zoe had seen him express anything other than impatience and indifference, and the effect was disconcerting.
"Good girl!"
Tulka brushed one hand over its snout, ruffling the fur beneath one of its horns.
"I bet there's probably some mook fruit for you around here somewhere."
Then, glancing back at Zoe, his smile faded.
"What?"
"If I'd known that spitting in your face was the key to your good graces," Zoe said, "I would have done it a long time ago." Ignoring her, Tulka returned his attention to the creature.
"You're a foul old girl, aren't you?" he said affectionately. "I used to hunt with one like you, back on Tula."
He glanced at the thick harness tethering the thing in its pen, and turned to look up ahead at the source of another noise, lower and more dissonant. Listening, Zoe heard it too. The stalls in front of them were full of an increasing din, braying and squabbling, getting louder every second. "Something's got them spooked," she said.
"Yeah."
Awareness dawned in the Whippet's face.
"I think you're right."
In the stables, the Tauntauns sounded as though they were screaming now, stomping in their paddocks. The lights went out. The blackness that engulfed them was crushing and total. Zoe felt Tulka's hand reach out and seize hold of her arm just below the shoulder.
"Stay close," his voice rumbled in her ear.
and she heard the creak of the leather quiver on his back.
Keep back.
Zoe felt her vision adjusting, straining after whatever slender traces of light she might find at the other end of the paddock. But there was precious little available, and what there was only created a myopic swamp of deep gray shadow. She could feel her senses reaching out into the recesses, pinging off the walls and ceiling. Her pupils ached from trying to pull something of substance out of the darkness. Immediately in front of her, she heard Talca suck in a sharp breath of air.
What?
She whispered. He jerked her forward so hard that her teeth snapped together, and all at once she was moving blindly, half running, half dragged through a black and sightless sea. The bounty hunter's grip on her arm was like a manacle. Swinging forward, losing her equilibrium and then regaining it, she felt the floor skid out from underneath her feet. She wondered how he could see at all, or if he was navigating by sense of smell or plain dumb luck. Then she felt them, coming up from behind. One or many, she didn't know, but the presence felt massive. An unwelcome intrusion of breath and motion and stinking flesh that bulked through the dark corridor, filling it. She heard a scream, a sound that she'd never heard before. It rose, a piercing shriek, pressurized and skating upward into the highest registers of audible sound. Thousands of vibrations per second until she expected it to burst apart, splintering into ragged strands and threads of individual voices. But instead, it held together, compressing somehow, overwhelming the cries of the tauntauns and everything else. Zoe sensed a probing, almost prehensile quality to that note. It was the echolocating noise of something, some things, investigating the blackness around them with a desperate, mindless voraciousness. As quickly as it had started, the scream broke off. The Tauntaun's cries had strangled away as well, leaving a void of utter silence in their wake. Zoe drew in a breath, summoning the force. What came next was a mental image, no longer than a second or two at the most, like a flash grenade exploding in her head. In that moment, she glimpsed the perimeter in front of them, the stalls and the space behind them. She had just enough of a view to sense what she had to do, now. She swung one leg in front of Tulka's ankle, planted her foot, and felt him trip over it, tumbling sideways with a snarled curse into an empty Tauntaun stall to their immediate right. Zoe collapsed on top of him. The night vision that the Force had given her was already gone. She felt something long and smooth jabbing painfully against her cheek, and realized later that it must have been one of the Whippet's tusks.
What? He snapped.
And this time she took hold of him, squeezing hard, digging her fingers as hard as she could into the bounty hunter's scaly, sweat-slick hide. In surprise, or maybe realization, he went quiet. The events of the next few moments weren't simply a matter of sound or smell, but some collusion of both sensory and extrasensory perception. With the Force guiding her, Zoe realized that she could feel the stalls alongside them, still pitch black, filling with the noxious stirring of many bodies, packed close together, piling past. Searching. At one point, Zoe sensed them lumbering by so closely that if she'd reached one hand out of the stall, she could have touched them. And they could have touched her. They weren't screaming now, weren't even breathing. Instead, the things, whatever they were, made little incidental grunting noises, the sounds of bodies pushing themselves along for the simplest of motives. Hunger, hatred, rage. She held her breath. Didn't move. After what felt like forever, the grunting noises trailed off, until all that was left was a putrid cloud that made her want to breathe through her mouth. Beneath her, Talca stirred, straightened, and shoved her off him.
If you ever do that again, I'll kill you myself.
Zoe glanced off in the direction that the things had gone. Seems a bit redundant, given the circumstances.
I don't run, and I don't hide.
Listen, she said. We saw what those things are. I can't fight them off, and neither can you. So for the moment, that leaves us with running and hiding. To her surprise, he didn't argue. Climbing out of the stall, they made their way forward through the dark, toward the strange pewter gray light she'd noticed earlier. It grew slightly brighter by degrees until she realized that she could see the exit taking shape in front of them. The air was colder, and she saw the first big flakes of snow drifting in from outside. Tulka stopped and tilted his head back, the wind blowing the fur from his face.
This isn't where we came in, he said.
How do you know? He raised one hand. Zoe looked where he was pointing. It took her a moment to realize what she was looking at. Once she did, though, she couldn't look away. They were back at the tower.
Chapter 28. What the Sickness Said.
In the dining hall, Lusk was watching the dead awaken. He saw it with two sets of eyes, the ones he'd had when he'd been alive, and the strange new vision that the sickness had given him. On some intuitive level, he understood that the first set was fading, going blind. And that was fine with him. Absolutely fine. The sickness had given him everything he'd hoped for, everything he wanted, power and strength beyond all imagining. It had altered the midichlorians in his bloodstream, telescoping his natural abilities, enhancing them exponentially. He had been here, of course, when the things burst out of the kitchen, and he defended himself adroitly with a series of force pushes and acrobatic jumps while weaker and less skilled students had fallen and been devoured. Within minutes, the things from the kitchen had transformed the dining hall into a charnel house of untrammeled butchery. Now the floors were slick with blood. The newly dead were rising slowly, shuffling to their feet. Rising up with them, Lusk stared into their faces. Faces that he recognized from the academy, now contorted into something utterly new. He felt no fear at the sight of them, no sense of foreboding, only a slick, dark fascination. I'm looking at my future, he thought, and shivered with anticipation. It was a good future, he realized. An endless future. A place of unfathomable possibility. He saw it all now. The rumor was that Darth Scabrous had been experimenting with an immortality drug, a remedy for death itself. And Lusk saw now that the Sith Lord had been successful beyond his wildest dreams and most deranged nightmares.